Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Lewenschein. In the second half of today's show, the Dakota Territory Air Museum permanently exhibits paintings by North Dakota artist Scott Nelson, which feature World War II aviators, including a B-17 bomber that was featured in the Apple TV series Masters of the Air. We'll visit with the artist. We begin today's show with author Dr. Judith Orloff and her new book, The Genius of Empathy. Dr. Orloff says that empathy involves understanding and sharing the feelings of others, often leading to supportive and compassionate behavior. It's about connecting with someone else's experience from their perspective and responding with kindness. Dr. Orloff, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much.
Your book is The Genius of Empathy, and as we discussed briefly off mic, it's a wonderful topic to consider in this world of bullying and all the noise we hear about the pressures of mental health and social media, et cetera. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about the book, but please tell me, what was the genesis of this book for you?
The genesis of this book was that I believe that empathy is the force that can help heal our families, our communities, and the world. I feel that it is that powerful and an important skill to learn, especially for children and parents and then young adults and in every situation. And so for that reason, I wanted to devote a book entirely on empathy to give people skills to be able to find empathy in even difficult situations.
Define for me, what is empathy?
Empathy is the ability to see something from another person's point of view without necessarily judging it, and to just be able to observe how they're seeing it and then establish your goal. What do I want to do with this person? Do I want to get through to this person? And then establish how to do that by wanting to know their point of view. You might not agree with their point of view. And that's a point I stress in the book, is that we have to get used to finding empathy for people we disagree with. That's a very important aspect of it.
You mentioned a single word as we had our introduction, and that word was learn. You talk about it throughout the book, that you're not born with empathy, or you may be perhaps, but you can really learn how to be empathetic. Expand upon that.
Yes, I mean, that's the premise of the book, is that we all can learn if we want to. If we want to have better relationships with our spouse, you know, with our children, you know, with teachers, with, you know, everyone in your life, empathy can help you do that. And empathy is about caring what other people think and where they're coming from. It's just really important. As people, you know, I'm a psychiatrist and I've worked with patients for, you know, 20 years. And what they all want is to be seen, to be heard, and to become valued. That's the basic desire of all people, no matter who they are on the outside. And so it's important in your communication. One of the first skills in learning how to express empathy is letting somebody know that you heard them. You might not agree with them, but you can say, I heard you, I'm going to give it some thought, and thank you. You don't have to agree with them, but then that's the alternative for getting into an argument or getting bitter or blaming or shaming or pointing the finger at somebody.
Like sending an email to someone and then getting a reply that said, I heard your point of view, but I disagree with it, rather than not getting any response from your email at all.
Yes. Oh, the no response response creates a lot of anger and resentment in people. So you want to be very careful not to do that, because then somebody feels like they're not heard at all, and that makes them irate.
You discuss the importance of self-empathy in your book. Explain that to me and how that differs from self-compassion and why it's crucial for personal healing.
Yes, I have a whole chapter in the book on self-empathy. It's about how to have empathy with yourself rather than putting yourself down and having those negative voices in your mind go round and round in a way that is destructive. So it's about saying, if you had a hard day, to say, you know, you did the best you could. It was an impossible situation and you got through it. Bravo. You know, this is the way one talks to oneself when they're empathetic. Now, we can't do everything perfectly all the time, but what we can do is show empathy for ourselves. And everybody goes through so much. I know that. And sometimes you can't tell what people are going through because they put on a pretty good front. But I'm, from my perspective as a psychiatrist, I know everybody has their own struggles. And so that's important to realize. It's a form of empathy, and it's how you treat yourself in an ongoing way. And it's a way to shut down the negative voices in your mind that can be so self-destructive. And, you know, my feeling is that we could make progress by just beating ourselves up a little bit less each day, because I know people are hard on themselves. And so a little bit of progress each day is a form of self-empathy.
Dr. Orloff, you write about that empathy is not just about being nice. Can you please tell me more about that?
Oh, yes. It's not just about being nice. It's about being discerning. It's about being able to assess how to approach people and how to get along with them and how to have better relationships. It's not about being nice or phony or being a people pleaser. Now, a lot of highly empathic people are people pleasers, and it's something they need to work with. And I have many tools in the book on how to, you know, not be a people pleaser, but be more true to yourself. A people pleasing is a form of codependency. So that's a little bit different. And so you need to be kind to yourself and listen to yourself as a very important vote in everything you do.
There's a time
you write say, when saying
no
does not mean you're not empathetic.
No. A misconception that a lot of people have about empathy is that you're weak, or that you bend to pressure, or that you can't stand up for yourself, or you just will absorb all the pain of the world into your own body, and you'll have to, you know, bear the brunt of compassion fatigue. That is not true if you have the tools that I'm sharing in the book in terms of setting clear boundaries with people. Now, somebody can ask you to do something and you know you can't do it, but the way you respond from an empathic point of view is to say, you know, I hear how important that is to you, but unfortunately, I just don't have the time to get involved right now, but I wish you the best of luck. And so that's setting what I call a positive boundary. It's not a wishy-washy boundary. It's not a mean boundary. It's a positive boundary, and it's not just being sugary sweet or nice. It has nothing to do with that. Although, if you're empathic, you will be perceived as nice.
You write about different empathy styles. That was interesting and educational for me. I believe my notes have cognitive, emotional, intuitive, and spiritual.
Right. And it's important that we could identify what style our loved ones are, our friends or coworkers, perhaps if we don't get along with them and we want to get along with them. So cognitive empathy is being able to feel empathy with your mind. You can say, I'm so sorry you went through that, and express, you know, a really beautiful expression of empathy, but you don't really feel it. You're not a feeling person. You're more a cerebral person, which is okay. You know, it's fine. I feel, you know, the more empathy we have on any level is good. And then the second kind is emotional empathy. And this is where many caring people feel what you're going through with their hearts. And they tend to become emotional sponges and take on the suffering or the problems of other people. And that needs to be shifted. And I have a big section in the Genius of Empathy on how to be with people and not take on their emotions. That's one of the skills. And then another kind of empathy is intuitive empathy, where you just naturally get intuitive flashes about people. You get gut feelings that are empathic. You get images, you get aha feelings, you get hunches. And so that's the way your empathy operates in a default setting. And then the final type of empathy is spiritual empathy. And I'm sure you've met, you know, these kinds of people who just see the best in everybody. They see, you know, what can is the potential in this person. And they see things from a spiritual and very loving, accepting point of view. The problem is that sometimes they don't see the whole person. They only see the best in them. And human beings have a very fierce, dark side, you know, and everybody knows that. So it's important to be able to recognize, you know, what is this person's obstacle? What is this person's dark side and how do I want to handle it? So there are positives and negatives with each type of empathy.
We are enjoying our conversation with Dr. Judith Orloff. Her book is The Genius of Empathy. She is a board-certified psychiatrist, intuitive healer, and New York Times best-selling author for her work on empathy, emotional healing, and the intersection of traditional medicine and spirituality. She's a member of the UCLA Psychiatric Clinical Staff. Dr. Orloff, you write a section in your book on how empathetic people can deal with bullies. I think it's one of the most important parts of your book. What should we take away from that?
Oh, it's so critical. You know, I just had, you know, my partner's grandson come visit us, and he is experiencing so much bullying in school. He's 8 years old, and, you know, it's a real problem, and it really hurts the kids, and it hurts adults who are bullied. But what you want to do if you're in a bullying situation is, number one, identify the bully and listen if it's a child or listen if it's an adult. And to get some help with that, because what happens with children is they sometimes lash out at a bully, and then the child who is defending themselves get blamed for the problem and gets kicked out of school or something like that. So you need to have an adult in the school system or in the resource system at work to come in and evaluate the situation, because many companies have zero tolerance for bullying, and many schools do. And so you want to get the help of somebody, you know, who can come in. You don't want to do it yourself. That doesn't usually turn out that well. And so you incorporate the help of, you know, the resource section of wherever you are. And you get some help in dealing with it. And you deal with the bully, the one who is bullying, and you deal with the victim, because it's very, very painful to be bullied. And so the one who is being bullied, you know, needs to have that empathic help. And you're not alone. And we're going to come in and solve the situation.
And I should stress that I think perhaps this is intuitive, but this is not just about youth who are being bullied. Many of us, for example, in work environments that are highly competitive, we're pushed around. We're bullied every now and then.
Oh, yeah, it's true. If it's every now and then, it's one thing. If it's every day, it's another thing. Because chronic bullying can have negative effects on your mental health and your physical health. It's a horrible way to live. No, luckily I've had, you know, small incidences of bullying, so at least I could get a sense of it. And you just have to have a big no to it. You know, there's no leeway there. But with children especially, because they need help. But in the workplace, if there's bullying going on, or if somebody's shaming you or blaming you, something like that, if you're in the book, I have different kinds of coworkers who might be difficult to deal with, and how empathy can help you establish a better relationship with them. It might not fix the relationship, but at least you'll be able to, you know, deal with them at work and stop the bullying. And so it's important, if somebody is bullying, you must realize that they're miserable people. You know, these are not happy kids. These are not happy coworkers. These are really miserable people. And so they're not coming from a happy place. You know, that doesn't excuse anything, but it's just to let you know that. And you can have empathy for, you know, their suffering, because bulliers often have been bullied as children. you know, if they're adult bullying and they're in your workplace, you know, you can try and set boundaries with them by saying, look, you know, we need to communicate with each other in a respectful way. You know, let's talk about that or let's do that. And if they're open to talking, fine. If they're not, you bring in human resources because it's a huge problem that you do not want to let go on and on.
You provide specific strategies for setting boundaries and discuss how boundaries are so important in practicing healthy empathy.
Absolutely. It's so important to be able to say, no, this is not okay, you know, and set a healthy boundary. And you don't want to have any kind of physical violence. And oftentimes with kids, they fight back, you know, and maybe not in the office, you don't physically fight back. But with children where it's so destructive, you know, they often fight back and get blamed for things. And so, you know, it's important that you learn how to set boundaries with bullying. It is never okay. You know, and if you're in a job situation where you're being bullied all the time and you've gone through the various positive, you know, assets that they have, there are people who can help you, and it's not helping, now I would consider another job if possible, because it has horrible effects on human beings. And so it's important to have zero tolerance, to say this is a difficult situation, but I'm going to handle it and I'm going to get some help. And especially at work, if you have coworkers who are, let's say, you know, bullies, but, you know, maybe not bullies, but they could be people who overtalk or people who are victims or drama queens or kings, you know, who wear you out with off the chart dramas. You know, how do you deal with them? And I have specific ways to deal with them. And just a quick tip is if you have a drama queen or king in your office and they're always grabbing you because you're the empathic person and telling you all their problems, you know, you don't ask them how they're doing. You know, you don't gaze deep in their eyes, you know, to engage them. You don't have body language that encourages them to say more. What you do say, and you can say it with empathy, is that, oh, I'm so sorry you have to go through this. You know, I'll hold good thoughts for you, and I've got to get back to my project now. And you say it, you know, within that time frame. Those, you know, what did that take me, 5 seconds? You know, or 10 seconds? You do not want to get into confrontations with bullies or coworkers who have various kind of personality disorders. And one thing is very important for you to notice is that if someone is a narcissist, because in my book, I have a whole chapter on what I call empathy deficient disorders. And these are narcissists, sociopaths, and psychopaths. And these people play by different rules because they don't have empathy. And this is so hard for sensitive, loving people to grasp. They think, if only I can do this for the person, if only, you know, I could open my heart, if only I could help them. And you can't really heal a full-blown narcissist. And that's part of awakening to empathy, is realizing the people who are non-narcissists, which is most of the people, but being able to identify a narcissist so you have an emotional communication strategy that works with them. It's a very different situation working with a narcissist.
Not a good one, in my view.
No.
Dr. Orloff, what is the sacred pause? Can you define that for us and why we should integrate that into our daily life to enhance empathy?
Yes, the sacred pause is that wonderful stopping point before you say something you regret. If you notice you're being emotionally triggered by someone, if you notice that you're about to say something that won't help the situation at all, and that you're emotionally reactive, the sacred pause is when you take 10 seconds, 20 seconds out. You notice that you're about to be triggered and say something that you know you will regret. And you take the pause, or you tell the person, you know, I need to go to the bathroom, or I need to just get out of the physical space for a short time and recenter yourself so that you don't send that email. You don't say something you regret. Because sometimes when you say things, people will never forget them if they're mean and if they're non-empathic. They won't forget them, and that causes damage to relationships. So the sacred pause is that wonderful time where you can regroup and not say something you regret or harm a situation.
The book is The Genius of Empathy, written by Dr. Judith Orloff. Dr. Orloff, in your experience, what are the most common misconceptions about empathy?
I think some of the most common misconceptions include that people who are empathic are soft, are weak, they can't stand up for themselves, they're unrealistic, they're the perfect victims for bullying. So that's a misconception about it, because in reality, people who have empathy also have strength. And when you learn some of the techniques such as setting boundaries, saying no, identifying bullying, really defining your own parameters and how you want to operate, you can say no in an empathic way. You could say no in a different kind of way than creating war. You want to have good relationships, and you don't want to create a war or bitterness. And it is so easy to create a war with somebody, whether it's a friend or a coworker or, in the global sphere. It's so easy. And communication is such an important skill to learn, empathic communication, so that you don't just do the same old, that, generations of countries and the world has just fallen into a weakness of war. And there's a book that I love called The Art of War. And I talk about it in the beginning of the book. And It says the war is a failure. And it's something to be miserable about. It's never something to be happy about. What we be happy about is that when we can communicate and reach a compromise, and we can hear each other as fellow humans. And empathy helps us connect and feel the connection between all the humans on Earth. And this is an absolute fact. When you have empathy, when you develop it, you can feel the connection to other humankind, all of the animals, the fish, all the life forms, the sentient life forms, because empathy lets you connect. Now, if you're just dealing with your mind and you're stuck in an overactive mind, you won't be able to feel what I'm talking about. But once you're able to have empathy for, a person you might not even know who's going through suffering, by just sending them, a loving energy, in your quiet time, just sitting and sending, some part of the world loving energy, it's more powerful than you know. It's not wishful thinking. And it's something to really practice in your life, to make your life happier with better relationships. If that's what you want, then empathy is the key to that.
You write and suggest that empathy can change the world. In the last 30 seconds or so that we have together, Dr. Orloff, give me a practical step that I can take to extend empathy in my personal relationships to then have a broader social impact. To then have a broader societal impact.
Yes, every day, be with somebody who has beliefs that are different than you, and begin to, get used to interacting with all kinds of people, not just people who believe like you do. So you can begin to have empathy and understanding for those who are not exactly like you. That's a big step.
Dr. Judith Orloff is a board-certified psychiatrist, intuitive healer, and New York Times best-selling author. She's written her latest book, The Genius of Empathy. Dr. Orloff, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed being on your show.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street. Coming after the break, North Dakota artist Scott Nelson's paintings of World War II aviators, including a B-17 bomber featured in the Apple TV series Masters of the Air. They're on permanent display at the Dakota Territory Air Museum in Minot. That's after this news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. North Dakota artist Scott Nelson's evocative paintings of World War II aviators are permanently showcased at the Dakota Territory Air Museum. Notably, his depiction of a B-17 bomber, prominently featured in the Apple TV series Masters of the Air, highlights his significant contribution to the portrayal of historical aviation.
Tell me the story, if you know the story, of how the production team came to use one of your paintings in Masters of the Air.
Well, I'll have to go way back 20 years ago. I started doing these paintings based on World War II aviators, you know, mostly from North Dakota. George Ott was one. He was a B-17 pilot, and he was flew deputy lead at the 2nd Schweinfurt. He was shot down. He was taken prisoner, and he ended up in Stalag Blue 3. I did the painting based on, you know, what had happened to him when his plane was shot down. And he was coming down to the ranch to view the painting. And he says, oh, by the way, I got a friend that's living in Dickinson now, and we use old war buddy, and could I bring him down? I said, well, certainly, you know, the more the merrier. Well, he comes down and he introduces me to this kind of a slight white-haired man with an eye patch. His name is Gail Clevin, went by Buck Clevin. Well, and then there was a guy from TV down. They actually did a story on George and his painting and his, you know, flying deputy lead at the 2nd Schweinfurt. This reporter asked, well, George says, well, this Buck Clevin, you know, he's got quite a story to tell. And this reporter tried to get his story. No, he wasn't going to say nothing. He did say he was in the 100th Bomb Group and he'd flown in the first Schweinfurt raid, which was August 17th of 43. But they went on to bomb Regensburg. Other than that, he wouldn't say nothing. It was George's day and he was going to be in the background. Well, a couple days later, I was up here in Mandan and I was at another veteran's place, Dick Barron. He was a P-47 fighter pilot and he had some books laying on his table. And I picked one up and opened it. It was, the name was Double Raid by Edward Jablinski. No kidding, the page I opened up, it was a picture of Gail Clevin.
Wow.
And I said, I looked at Dick, I says, this guy was in my house just the other day. I got Buck's phone number from George Ott, and I called him. I says, you know, funny thing happened the other day. I found this book, and here you're in this book. Yeah, he says that was, that author spread it on a little too thick. And then I started finding him written in up in all these books. At this time, I was interviewing for the Veteran History Project, and I could not get him to do an interview. You know, he just would not talk about it. But I gleaned that he was shot down on the Bremen mission of October 8th, 1943, exactly a week earlier than George Ott was shot down. But I'd go up and have coffee with them guys, or we'd go out for a meal in Dickinson, and Buck and George would sit and visit about all the stuff that happened in Stalag Blue 3. You know, mostly the humorous stuff that happened. They never did into the dark stuff. I was invited down to Lemmon, November 11th, Veterans Day of 2003. And the guy down there was putting on this deal for Veterans Day, wanted me to bring my paintings down. Plus then he invited all these veterans and most of them came down to this deal. Well, I didn't have a painting, a Buck, but I knew he was in the 100th Bomb Group. And they had a big square D on the tail. And the thing is, why they were going down there, he was actually born near Lemmon. So George and Buck went down early in the day and they went and found his homestead down south of Lemmon. And so that was the reason. And he had no idea anything else was going to happen. But I did this painting, just a real quick watercolor.
Of a B-17?
A B-17 from the 100th Bomb Group. And that's pretty much all it was. And there was some German planes in there and stuff, you know. I was bringing up these big paintings. And then I'd tell the story. And then the veteran could come up and kind of tell his side of it. I know I did four or five, and there was, I know Dick Barron was down there, and Noble Peterson, and George Ott, and toward the last, I said, well, I got a little surprise. And I brought out this watercolor and set it on the easel. And I says, well, now he don't talk much, but this represents Buck Clevin. And he was in the 100th Bomb Group, and he was shot down at Bremen, October 8th of 43.
This is all well discussed in Masters of the Air.
Yes.
That's streaming now on Apple TV.
Right. And I said, now he's a little shy, but maybe we can get him up to talk. And he actually got up and talked, which he rarely ever did. Well, practically didn't. And that's the only videotape they have of Buck. And he got up and talked and told what, very humorous. Everything he talked about was humorous. Kind of had a quip, you know, kind of a low-key sense of humor, dry sense of humor. Well, 2 days after that happened, I get a letter in the mail. Big fat letter. Here it's his copies of his journal he kept at Stalag Blue 3 that tells all about getting shot down. He knew the plane was called Our Baby, but that was the only time he ever flew that plane because he was a squadron leader. He never had his own plane. He was just flying different planes within the squadron. I contacted Michael Faley of the 100th Bomb Group, and he had all the information on the plane, you know, all its markings. And see, Buck flew off to Bremen, and he didn't come back. And so they're wanting the audience to feel, well, was he killed? Was he wounded? Is he a POW? Is he evading? See, nobody. And that's the way it was back then. The plane, and they said he went down with no chutes. Well, that's a bad sign, because that could mean they were all killed. Mm-hmm. So they didn't know. So they wanted the audience to feel that, like they felt back at base. Because the story has been Buck and Egan up to this point, pretty much. All of a sudden, Buck's gone. Was he killed? You know.
As you're watching Masters of the Air, Scott, the intensity of what these airmen went through, it's emotional. And you know their stories well and now have seen this. What has been going through your mind as you've been watching what they endured?
Well, it's pretty much the way they described, because it was very intense.
Unbelievable courage.
George Ott's in at the second Schweinfurt. There were German bombers flying over them, dropping bombs on them. They had twin-engine fighters with rockets on them that were lobbing rockets into the formations. And he said they were just getting hit from every direction. So very much they did depict that very well, you know. Some people might think it was overdone. It's not.
How did you feel when you were watching it?
Well, knowing Buck the way I did, it was kind of hard to get used to Austin Butler playing him. The thing is, there's so much there, and there was so much to cover. Now, if they could make like an 18-part series out of it, maybe they could cover, but they miss so many important parts because they just cannot cover it. Because it's all, you know, like I would have liked to seen the early stuff during training, like they did in Band of Brothers and that. Because there was one part in there, they were based in Nebraska, and then they tried to fly everybody to California. When they got in the air, they just went a lot of them went and visited their girlfriends, and they almost broke up the group because of that.
And these are airmen who 2 or 3 years prior really didn't know what an airplane was. And now all of a sudden, by the hundreds, if not the thousands, these young men were being trained to fly.
Yep. And all these kids, you know, that grew up just dreaming of flying an airplane. But, you know, it was the 30s and their money was tight and there was no way. But here this war came along and allowed them to become pilots and air crew members on these planes.
When did you realize that you wanted to recreate the great World War II paintings that you've done?
I did one painting of a B-17 and some German fighters, but it was just all from, you know, just I got some books and looked at the pictures, but everything was wrong, of course, because, you know, I didn't do the research. It wasn't anything that actually happened, but then I got to thinking, you know, I want to interview somebody, and I really didn't know anybody that I didn't think because these guys didn't stand out. But it turned out, you know, they're all around us, you know, these aviators and World War II veterans, you know, because so many of them never talked about it. When I started with Noble Peterson, well, then people started coming to me. You got to talk to this guy. You got to talk to that guy. There was a guy in our church, Ed Atkinson, and they said, you got to talk to him. You know, he flew during the war and he was shot down. And I had never known it. Knew him very well, but, you know, he wasn't somebody that ever talked about flying. He flew L-4s. Which was the most feared plane. But now you'd think, the B-17s or the P-51s, the Germans would fear them the most. No, it was the little L-4 Piper Cub, because they could fly above the battlefield and direct the whole battalion of artillery on a target. They were scared to death of those little planes.
I've flown in a B-17, Scott, and I know that you haven't gotten the opportunity to do that. What's striking to me is, and they talk about this in Masters of the Air, is the environment inside the plane. If it's 20 below outside, it's maybe not quite 20 below, but it is dang cold inside. Up to 50 below is in the series. There's no insulation in the heaters, and you've got gunners that are exposed, and all of a sudden they're hit, and now their window's open.
Yep.
And they endured this.
And they had heated suits, but so many times those heated suits malfunctioned, and so they were just, you just can imagine, like if it's 30 below, like it is in North Dakota here sometimes, going out, and, and they're pretty much just sitting. They're not real active unless you're a gunner and you're working your gun and stuff. But
how many World War II paintings do you think you painted?
All of them are up at the Minot Air Museum, Dakota Territory Air Museum, and I think I got something like 15 up there. It's 15 paintings.
We're recording this in the Mandan Public Library, and there are several prints of your paintings here for people see. How did your relationship begin with the Dakota Territory Air Museum?
I'd go out and kind of have showings and that, and there was a guy that came to me, and he was a board member up there. He was thinking maybe I'd put prints up there, and I said, actually, I'm looking for a place for these paintings. And I said, I don't want to sell them. I want to keep them all together. I want them someplace where people will see them. And he says, boy, do we have a deal for you. I call them on loan. Because if ever something would happen to the museum, I wouldn't want them to be sold off. I'd like to take possession of them again. But they set up a gallery up there with my paintings, and they have the stories on them. And that's what's most important, is the paintings are okay, but it's the stories behind them is what's really important.
And because of those stories, were they ever difficult for you to paint? How did you make that transition from creating something that is, it's beautiful, and I hesitate to use that word because you know what's behind every brushstroke that you made?
When I first started, I took the veterans' word for everything. What they told me is what I put in the painting. I didn't do any research. Well, I found out I had to do research because they'd get things wrong. And it wasn't on purpose. They just remember things wrong. Like Wendell Skay told me about when he flew in his bomb group. He said they were olive drab. Well, he actually flew out of Rapid City down here with B-17s, and they were olive drab. But by the time he'd got over to England, they were using the unpainted ones, the silver ones. But in his mind, he was still flying the green ones. So I painted it in olive drab, which was wrong. And I had the markings wrong on it because I just went by what he said. From there, I learned I had to start researching, because it was one thing what they said, and then it was quite another sometimes with what actually happened. Their memories after that many years, and they just misremembered things. And so that's why when I did this stuff on Buck, Michael Faley really helped me out, because he had all that information that Buck didn't know. And so that was a big part of it then. I'd get the story, I'd research the story, and then I'd usually, these bomb groups and stuff, they'd have a website and they'd have a historian. And then I'd contact them. And then a lot of times they'd have the mission reports, so I could go off of them. That was a learning, kind of a learning curve for me.
Did you learn about why the plane was named Our Baby?
No. I mean, that was just, sometimes the people that named it weren't around anymore, and it was just something that, I don't know, and there was no pictures of it. And so when Buck said it was Our Baby, and I contacted Mike Faley, and I says, is there any pictures of these planes? So many times there was pictures, but there was no picture. Well, not, there was some pictures, but you couldn't see the nose art on it.
You have watched veterans look at these pictures. What have they told you? What have they told you about what you've allowed people to remember?
I don't get much comments out of the veterans themselves.
Really?
Yeah. It's other people that are interested in it.
Do you feel
really
that this
appreciate
is
them?
A part of history that America maybe is starting to forget about a little bit?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. Masters of the Air touches on it. But, when they went over there and started bombing Germany, and they said, Europe was a fortress, occupied by Germany, Nazi Germany, but it didn't have a roof over it. Well, they went and started, and the English would bomb at night, Americans do daylight bombing. And they had so many planes. In the beginning, in 43, they had so many planes shot down. So many people killed. It was a failure, you know, and we weren't doing the damage to the submarine pens and stuff. And they actually should have probably quit. But if they would have quit the bombing offensive, because what they were using these bombers for was bait to bring up the German fighters. And once they got the P-51 in there at the end of 43, they wiped out the German Air Force. In the beginning, it was a total failure. I mean, they were losing, you know, sometimes they'd get all their planes shot down. You know, the second Schweinfurt, they lost 60 planes, 600 air crew members. And the damage they did to the ball bearing plants was minimal. And plus, they were buying ball bearings from Sweden and Switzerland. They had all kinds of ball bearings, and they didn't find that out till after the war. You know, we lost so much more.
You told me off mic that it's going to now be difficult for you to paint more pictures because the veterans that you want to talk to aren't here anymore.
Right. Well, and people have said, well, you should do the Vietnam and stuff, and I'm just not interested. I don't know. Getting to know these guys and getting to be good friends with them and then losing them, that's what happened, you know, because I was still young and they were, you know, up in their 80s and 90s, and, you know, that was hard.
Have you had any more contact with the filmmakers after you learned that Our Baby was then used in Masters of the Air?
You've seen the first episode, and it's the bar scene. The day that was filmed, Don Miller, author of Masters of the Air, called me from London, and I called him back. He says, the director is having a problem with Buck Cleven and Egan. And he said, they are so different. And he says, is there anything that you could tell us that would, you know, because what did they have in common? You know, all the time I knew Buck, he never mentioned Egan. Egan died fairly young. He was in his 40s. So I couldn't help him out. But we talked for 20 minutes about, you know, about Buck and stuff, but I wasn't able to help him.
What inspired you to become an artist? I think you've told me before you're self-taught.
Yeah, my mom said that. As soon as I could, I wasn't even walking yet, but I got a hold of a piece of paper and a pencil, and I was on the floor drawing pictures. The folks sent me, because I showed an interest in art, and they sent me to some class in Bismarck one time, and I wanted to draw what I wanted to draw, and they were trying to get me to draw other stuff, and it just didn't work out. I wanted to draw dinosaurs and horses. And
where'd you grow up, Scott?
30 miles south of Mandan on our place, homesteaded by my grandparents in 1908.
And you're still there today?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I never learned to do nothing else. I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up, in fact.
So. How did that influence, do you think, your being able to be such a great painter?
Oh, I'm not a great painter.
I think you are.
I'm way down when you look at the other stuff. And the only reason this one is because it's connected to Buck. And that's if this wouldn't have anything to do with Buck, it would be just another picture. I mean, there is some really good artwork out there.
You had an event, Scott, at the Heritage Center in Bismarck. What was that about?
About the stories and telling the stories of just a lot of what I was telling you here. And then leading into this Masters of the Air and the connection that this Buck Cleven had, you know, with North Dakota and Lemon, and the fact that he had lived a couple years in Dickinson.
Are all of your paintings signed by the people that you wanted to paint?
Most of them are. But the last one I did, he passed away before I was able to get him to sign it. And that kind of, then after that, I didn't have a lot of interest because they were to an age, their memories are gone and stuff. And that's where I just kind of quit with it, yeah.
What reaction did you get when they would sign your paintings?
Look at it and they think, oh yeah, that's pretty good. Other people could pick out, if I got stuff wrong in it, other people could pick it out, but the veterans would never do that. They just look at it, yep, that's pretty much the way it is, you know.
What's next for you in the art world? Scott, are you done or are we going to see more work from you?
I just take one day at a time. So
you like to write quite a bit? Do you prefer writing now more so than
I do.
Artwork?
I can express myself better. I actually write a column and then to keep my artwork going, I include a little sketch or a little watercolor in the column just to keep the art side going with it. So
where can people learn more about your work?
They can go to scottnelsonart.com. And there's quite a bit there, so I don't keep it up like I should, but yeah, there's stuff there.
I would encourage listeners to go take a look because, Scott, I think your work is representative. You can see the emotion that was occurring when many of these either fighters or bombers were being shot down, crew members jumping out of the airplanes. It's all there, Scott. You've done a wonderful job.
Well, in any one of these guys, they could write a book because the stuff that they went through is just, but you know, so much was happening during World War II. You know, there were so many stories and so many heroes and you know, if something happens now, right away they got a book deal, you know, that if they were on a plane that went down or were rescued, you know, it's, and this, it was all, and the thing was, they didn't talk about it. Many of them didn't talk about it till they got old enough where they could finally open up. And they needed somebody there to kind of, because they didn't think anybody was interested, but they needed somebody there, and I kind of learned the language, you know, and I knew how many crew members were on a bomber, and I knew the kind of what they flew and all their duties, and that kind of got them to open up where they wouldn't, you know, normally. Because I heard stories that the kids never heard.
Scott, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much.
And by the Bush Foundation, investing in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Applications for the Bush Fellowship will be open from September 17th through October 15th. More information about the Bush Fellowship can be found online at bushfoundation.org. Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 20th. On this date, in 1892, the Fargo Society column of the Wisconsin Afro-American wrote, "The Afro-American man is always wide awake and never neglects anything that will benefit the colored people of Fargo. Every colored citizen should subscribe for this paper." Black people in Fargo of 1892 could buy the Wisconsin Afro-American at the barber shop of Nathan Norris at 63½ Broadway. Today we might wonder what wide awake meant in the context in this historical document. In 1892, it was a term laden with meaning. It conjured up visions of grim abolitionist crusaders marching in torchlight parades in black capes. A few decades earlier, in 1860, the Wide Awakes were the enthusiastic paramilitary youth wing of the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln. It was also the party of Hans Christian Hegg, an immigrant Norwegian-American, commander of a local Wisconsin militia that defended fugitive neighbors against slave catchers. He could be found drilling wide awakes in the streets of Fox Lake, Wisconsin. He was a fiercely abolitionist colonel of the 15th Regiment Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry, who died at the Battle of Chickamauga during his personal crusade against slavery. In the hot weather and hot politics of the 1860 presidential election, the boots of the wideawakes thundered across the streets of northern cities. They thundered even more loudly in the imaginations of southern slave owners. The very mention of wideawake threw Texan mobs into a frenzy. They scapegoated abolitionists for summer fires that broke out in the hot sun of 1860. Their false accusations of abolitionist arson would get repeated by John C. Breckinridge, vice president in the James Buchanan administration, who is now the presidential nominee of the Southern Democrats after they split with Northern Democrats and walked out of the National Convention. Texan mobs tortured hundreds of enslaved people to extract confessions and lynched dozens of people suspected of Northern sympathies. Black people of that period understood what it meant when, in 1890, the Torchlight Appeal of Fort Worth, Texas, an African-American publication, called itself a wide-awake weekly newspaper for the people. Black people in Fargo of 1892 knew what the phrase wide-awake meant. It had a history. It had an iconography. It had a clear meaning, a meaning long forgotten in popular memory. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll get you ready to go back to school, but perhaps in a way you've given little thought to. David Steinman has written the book, Raising Healthy Kids, Protecting Them from Hidden Chemical Toxins, and he'll be our guest. And we hope you'll also be our guest tomorrow on Main Street.